Is that a Hogwarts thing too?
This one? Green? No, this is Elphaba from Wicked the Musical. Yeah,
okay.
It's okay. And then Lily is Fire Stamp, which is like
here.
So, yeah, so I spent a long time picking out things.
Yeah.
Yeah, at one point there was like $150 worth of stickers in my cart, and I was like, that can't be. So I.
$150?
Yeah, I know. I got it down to like 30, and I was really proud of it.
All right. Very nice. Very nice. Yeah. All right.
Oh, case in point, my grandma just sent me a birthday card, and they had a Labrador in it because, you know, that makes sense.
Nice. I had a back-end keyboard protector, but it doesn't work on the new keyboard, but it's not a All right, good morning, everybody. Welcome to Friday. Hope everybody's doing well. Logan, what were you listening to? What was it?
Solitude and
Blues. Not a clue. All right, good. What kind of music? Well, the psychedelic rock stuff I'd like. All right. Email me a link, please. I'd like to see it. Okay, good. Thanks, everybody. I hope you've all had a great week. Obviously, we're at the weekend. I had, if you remember, I asked you to read Cato, a Tragedy for Monday. So, and think about if you'd be willing to do some readings. That is, if you'd be willing to do some parts in here, and we're going to go over it. But this is the actual book. You don't have to buy this, obviously. Just to let you know, and I've got it up on the screen, and I'll turn this off in a moment. But if you still haven't found it, it's at the Online Library of Liberty. And if you just type out Online Library of Liberty in Google, it will come right up. And then you can see there, I've got Cato, a Tragedy. That's all moving, right? Yeah. So I've got Cato, a Tragedy, typed it in, and it comes right up. So make sure, well, actually, I think it gives you a couple of choices. Let's see. Yeah, it does. So you just want this one, the one that says Cato, a Tragedy and Selected Essays. Grab that, and then if you just scroll down a little bit, you can hit the LF printer PDF version, and that version right there, you need to jump forward a little bit, go to page 5, somewhere, come on, Christine, one more. There we go. So we get to it, Cato, a Tragedy, and there you have it. There's page 5. So it's that's exactly, you know, I turned to page 5 here. It is exactly the same layout. So what you have right there was the printer's layout. So they sell all their books at cost, but everything's also free if you want to download it, which is what I'm expecting you all will do. So you only need to read pages 5 through 99, just the play itself. So the prologue and the epilogue, and that's it. Make sure that you've read all through those. And we'll talk about those more on Friday, on Monday. But just to let you know, has anybody had trouble finding it? Hopefully you've got it. And you don't need to print it out, as I think I told you. If you just want to read it on your iPhone, or as long as you can get to it quickly, you're probably more dexterous than I am with the iPhone. If you can get to what we're going to look over quickly, that's fine, or your iPad or your laptop. So you can just read it straight off. You can also print it, obviously, but I know the library gets a little upset if you print too many copies, and I get calls. So anyway, do know that as you're reading it, the story is about, it's a true story, but the dialogue's made up for the sake of the play. Joseph Addison was the single most important literary critic of the 18th century, and next to that is pre-Boswell and Johnson. So I should say maybe the second or third most important, but one of the most. And he writes this play, which was not successful in Britain. It was a flop in Britain. But he writes this play as a way of trying to explain Roman republicanism to a Britain that is seemingly becoming more and more decadent. So he's worried that Britain is going the same way that Rome had. And therefore, he writes this story about Cato. But Cato, of course, is a pagan. He's a Stoic. And he has to make that palatable to a Protestant audience. So a lot of what you're going to get is an attempt by Addison to Protestantize pagan Stoicism and to make it acceptable to a British audience. So you're not going to get pure paganism. You're also not going to get pure Protestantism. But you'll get some kind of hybrid. And then to make matters worse, of course, Cato's a suicide. So by any Christianity, the Orthodox Christianity, suicide is automatic hell. But his suicide is so drawn out that he actually has almost a confession in which he recognizes this may not have been the right thing to do. And at some point in terms of the play, even though I love Cato, you kind of want him to die because it's just like he keeps talking. He's like, man, you slit your wrist like 5 hours ago. You need to die. And he doesn't until, you know, very much at the end. And he's got with him the dialogue of the soul from Plato. And he's really hoping. He's like, oh, man. If God is not this, I hope he forgives me for this. So you do get the moment of confession at the end, which is why, and we'll talk about this, why Dante, of course, gives him very, very high place. He has a higher place than Aristotle, Plato, or Socrates, or Cicero. Dante makes him the guardian of purgatory, which is amazing to think about. Why would he be that figure, even though he's a suicide? So this play, as I mentioned the other day, was the single favorite play of George Washington. Washington was about the only one of the founders who was not classically educated. His classical education came from memorizing Cato, a Tragedy. So his whole understanding of the classical world, not all, I shouldn't say whole, but about 90% of his understanding comes from having memorized this play and loving it. So he has it performed 7 times. And in his own letters, which were, as a young man, we can talk about this when we get to Washington, I love Washington, but he has his faults. We'll talk about those faults. But in his own letters, this is not a fault, but his letters are a fault because he was writing to a married woman. He was getting into very, very suspect territory as he was writing to this older woman, Lady Fairfax, and he was clearly infatuated with her. And she'd be with him, even though she's married, and he's 10 years younger. But he signs all of these letters as Juba. And that's because he sees himself as Juba, who, if you've had a chance to read the play, you know, is a black African. It's really interesting for a slaveholder to have a hero as a black African. So I want you to think about that. And why is that the case? And what is it that Addison, by making Juba the hero of the story, Cato's not the hero. Cato is like you guys going up and trying to have a conversation with the Winston Churchill statue. Right. You may really respect Winston Churchill. He's not going to talk back to you. You guys get that, right? And Cato is a statue. He's a talking statue. He's not a weeping angel. but he is a talking statue, and there's not a lot of development. You're kind of going up and getting the answers of God when you talk to Cato the Younger. That's really critical. So just think about that as he's dying. He really is kind of a divine presence, but he's stone. He's not emotional. He's a true stoic. So just kind of keep that in mind as you're reading this. It's really important. You can read about, obviously you're going to be reading about the love affairs and things going on as well. That is important. I don't know exactly how important, but mostly I want you to kind of get who is Cato, what is virtue, and what is a republic. Okay, so look at that. But you can write your paper on anything. You don't need to do any research. I just want you to write your paper for Friday dealing with what you have in the play. If you like one of Cato's daughters and you want to write about them, fine. Totally fine. If you thought the love interest was good, go for it. If you want to write about Cato, that's fine. If you want to write about Juba, anything. You guys have total free reign. But don't do any research. Everything you need should be right there in the play, and I want to see how you analyze it. But the themes are completely open. So whatever you want to write about is completely fine with me, as long as it deals with this play. Okay? So, does that help for getting ready for Friday? Or for Monday? All right. Good. Yes?
Do you want us to clear our topics with you?
No. Not at all. Just go for it. Not a good time.
Okay.
And I think things will be clarified. Since we'll spend all of Monday reading it, I think things will be pretty clear.
Great.
But you can go any direction you want. So, and I hope, for those of you who have me before, you know this, I never, ever grade you on your views. Never. I mean, it would be totally inappropriate as a professor to do that. I will, however, grade you on how you get to your views. So that's what I'm looking at. Make your argument. You can be atheist, communist, fascist, totally the opposite of me, and I still will accept it as long as you make the good argument. I mean, I'll talk to you in the cafeteria, but I will certainly grade you as fairly as well. I'm joking, but I'll grade you as fairly as possible.
Oh,
yeah, communists and fascists are just flip sides of the same. They're all freaks. All right, so, okay. All right, here we go. So, for today, and I've got a lot on the board already, but here's what I want to try and break things down as we move into the Declaration of Independence and also talk about the founding. There are a number of things that I have on this side of the board, and sorry, I can see this is crazy. I wrote all this out in the first lecture, and it made more sense. I think as I was writing it out. But these three things I want to talk about as ways of thinking for the founding. So here we have this. Here we have, let's take this to you. I'm going to take one here. I can't pass it on. I should have enough for everybody. If not, let me know and I'll make a few more copies. So what I have here is just a layout, a handout of chronology of how we move towards the American Revolution. That is how things break down between Britain and the American colonies. So we've already talked a little bit about James Otis. James Otis is this incredible figure who gives his talk on the writs of general assistance, going against them, talks about search and seizure. This is why we have the Fourth Amendment to the United States. The beginning of the American Revolution begins with Otis's speech. But notice, it's a full 15 years until actual fighting breaks out. So I don't want anyone to think that the Americans ever go into war lightly. They are not going into it lightly. In fact, quite the opposite. They're taking it dreadfully serious. And they're trying to figure out at what point are we more English than the English? At what point have the English failed? So there are three major ideas that will come together in the American mind that will allow them, I don't know any other way to put it, it will give them the sanction, it will allow them to take up weapons against their government. This is a group of farmers, and farmers are headstrong, but farmers usually don't like a lot of disorder. 96 to 99% of all Americans are involved in farming. So imagine, why are these farmers, generally the most conservative people you can ever find in the history of the world, why would farmers take up arms against their own government? Is a very, very difficult question to ask, and it's a very difficult question to answer. How do we arrive at that situation? So something has to develop, not just being ticked off. Yet we all know in radical societies, one small thing can ignite a revolution. It happens all the time. But this is not a radical society. This is a deeply conservative society. So what is it that breaks apart the social fabric that allows them to declare themselves essentially more English than the English. That is, how do we become greater than the English? How did the English betray our trust? So these three ideas, I'm going to list them and then I'll come back to republicanism. These three ideas are Protestantism, republicanism, and liberalism. These three things give a basis to the American founders to go ahead and revolt and to say it's not only a necessary thing, it's a good thing. Which is hard to do. Killing someone is probably even, well, not for sociopaths, but anytime that you go into war, anytime you make a decision to defend yourself, these are difficult things, and you have to live with what you've done. And so starting a war or revolution is not something that should ever be taken lightly at any level, and you always want to exhaust every possibility before you take that step. So this is how the founders think. They're conservatives in the best sense, so they're not radicals. So the first thing, which I think should be clear from everything we've talked about so far, is that the American people are deeply, deeply Protestant. And they're not just Protestant. Even Protestants would think they're Protestant. That is extreme. They are the extreme of Protestants. As Edmund Burke said, there have never been a people in the world who have been more Protestant than these Protestants. And they're so Protestant in America that the chances are very good that a John Calvin, one of the greatest of Protestants, or a Martin Luther, also one of the greatest of Protestants, and here we are in the 500th anniversary of Lutheranism and Protestantism, they would not recognize our Protestants. These guys are Protestants beyond Protestants. They have taken another step. And in their radicalism, all Orthodox by theology, but in their radicalism, they have basically come to the idea that they are single-handedly responsible for their own relationship with Christ. So there's no church, there's no intermediary, even though they go to church. But the church is merely a kind of functional thing as a community. They believe wholeheartedly that their relationship is Brad to Jesus. That's the relationship. And therefore, anything that would ever come in between that relationship is anathema, is dangerous. Maybe a minor danger, maybe a great danger, but it is certainly very, very dangerous. So we happen to have a few very solid statistics, amazingly enough, in a time period that didn't collect enough information, at least from a perspective of a modern historian. If we look at 1775, we know that if we were to talk to the average American, so I'm talking whites here, we would talk to an average free American in the colonies in 1775, and we would ask them about their religion. Their Protestantism would shape every single decision they make, whether it's family, farming, whether it's government, where to attend church, obviously, everything. And I'll read a passage probably on Wednesday, but by a great scholar, and you don't need to know her name. Her name's Patricia Bonamy, and my wife and I were just debating this weekend if she's retired or not. She should be. If she's not, she's got to be close. Great historian. But she writes that, you know, if we walk into a modern city, and what do we see? We see skyscrapers. If you were to walk into any colonial city, you would see church spires. And that's what was the architecture, everything. The bells determined when you went to work, when you got up, when you ate dinner, everything. Everything was decided by your religious faith. We've really not seen in the modern world a people more devout to their religious faith than these Protestants were. And it was everything for them, everything. And if you were to ask the same thing in England of people, you would have only found about 10% of the population there that would have taken it as seriously as the Americans. So in other words, what we find, and I think this is critical, by 1775, if we're going to use religion as a factor, we don't even recognize the British anymore, and they don't recognize us. We're a very different people. And of course, to this day, you know, anybody in here not an American citizen? I'm not trying to pick you, I'm just curious. Okay, so we're all American citizens. One thing, and if you've met Europeans your age, one of the things they love to do, this is a laugh. This is a great lark for 20-year-old Europeans who come over and visit America. One of the things they do is they drive around Sunday mornings and go to church parking lots. And they just laugh at how many people are in church. How many cars are there? This is hilarious to them. Because they are so beyond this. It doesn't matter if you're in Catholic Austria or Lutheran Denmark. The only time you ever go to church, ever, is maybe on Christmas and maybe on Easter. And this was true even when I was your age. So I spent my sophomore year at the University of Innsbruck. I was there from July of 87 to July of 88. One of the best years of my life, obviously, outside of marriage. Just amazing. But yeah, I'd go to Mass, and it would basically be me and then about 30 really old women. And that was it. And it's disheartening, you know, to do that. But that's Europe. And we're not like that. We're going that direction, but we're not there yet. And so this is very much, this deep religiosity is very much a part of our DNA. It's a part of being American. And for these people who were Protestant, what this means is, as Protestants, they're extremely anti-authoritarian in every level. They're also very decentralized. So they look at things and they say, look, if my relationship is straight to Jesus, then why would I ever care about congressman or president? Or, that's minor play stuff compared to my God. So if I can have a direct relationship to Jesus, I certainly don't need to have an intermediary in politics either. So this is a radical decentralization. And it also means, even though most Americans have never met a Roman Catholic, Roman Catholicism becomes the ultimate evil in the world in their minds. Now, they don't get Roman Catholic theology. They don't understand it. It doesn't matter. It's a symbol. In the same way that when I was growing up, and you guys don't have this because we're pretty much past it, but when I was growing up, all I had to say was someone was a commie, and we all knew they're bad, and you get this kind of nasty feeling. It's like, oh yeah, commies are just scum, right? And the same thing was true for my grandfather's generation. If you said fascist, right? And of course, we still carry that with this. You know, if I were in Colorado and I said commie, half the guys would scratch their head, and girls too, say, oh, is that good or bad? I'm fascist. We don't know that's bad, right? It's the same thing. If I were to just say Catholic in Boston in 1775, that's just bad. And it's that kind of thing. They don't really know what Catholicism is. They just know it's bad. It's superstitious, it's tyrannical. Now that matters, because when we look, for example, at the New Englanders, when they go into battle during the American Revolution, their war cry, it's not Geronimo, Geronimo doesn't exist yet, it's not Remember the Alamo, that hasn't happened yet, their war cry, good Connecticut men running into battle, good New England men, their war cry is, no king, no pope. That's what they chant. Now, is there anyone in this room who actually thinks that the British had won the War of Independence, that the Pope would have any power in America? This is a total absurdity. British king hates the Pope as much as the Americans do. But that symbol is huge. And this is why I asked the last class this as well. Anyone want to take a guess? You all should know this. Bishops are not just Catholic. There are Methodist bishops. There are Lutheran bishops. There are Anglican bishops, not Baptist bishops. That actually sounds funny to even say. But there are bishops, right, in a lot of Protestant religions. How many of those bishops ever walked on American soil prior to American independence? Anyone want to take a guess? Give me a ballpark figure.
Two.
Yeah, it's a great one. It's a good guess. Subtract two.
Oh.
And you got it. Not one. And why? Because the king is bad, but the bishop is the worst symbol of tyranny ever. Because the bishop can tell you what to read and when to worship or not. That's terrible. Even American Anglicans who have bishops won't allow them to come over to American soil. Plus, the bishops aren't full enough to come because they're going to get blown away if they come onto America. Someone's going to kill them. And that would be considered manly to do that. Okay. So there are no bishops on American soil. No Protestant bishops, certainly no Catholic bishops, ever. First bishop ever to walk on American soil is a Marylander by the name of John Carroll. And the only reason he's named bishop is because the Pope, very, very nervous about appointing a bishop in America, calls the most radical atheist in America, doesn't call him, but actually sends two diplomatic emissaries to meet him, Ben Franklin. and says, look, we want to have a bishop in America, but we don't want to offend American Protestants. Who do we pick? And Franklin says, you've got to pick John Carroll. He's the only one. Lo and behold, John Carroll's our first bishop. Who would have thought that Franklin would have been the one to give that name? That's amazing. So anyway, I just want you to keep this in mind. This is deeply rooted in American society. All right, the second thing that matters for us, and we'll come back and define this, but the second thing, we love republics. You're reading Cato, A Tragedy, which is nothing if not about what a republic is. We love republics. We want a republic. We know that republics have not existed since Cicero was murdered. But we believe very firmly it is the only proper way of governance. We don't like democracies. We don't like monarchies. We don't like aristocracies, but we love republics. And so republican thinking is everywhere. And we're going to keep talking about that to the point you guys will be sick of it by the end of the year. But it's going to be everywhere, and you have to know, and you have to define it and talk about what it means. The final thing here, and I'm going to go back to republic in a moment, but the final thing I want you to understand is we also have what would have been called, now this is not modern liberalism, this is not Hillary Clinton's liberalism, but we would go back and call this liberalism in the 18th century, and it means exactly what I have here, and that is liberalism meant free minds, free markets, and free immigration. You don't have borders, whether we're talking about trade goods or people. People have every right to move from one part of the world to another, and nothing can stop them. There are no walls, there are no barriers, there are no passports. Americans totally believe people should be able to move the goods and themselves. Now, we call this liberalism looking back at it. The Americans never would have called this liberalism. They would have called it reality, because there was no theory. They're not reading theory, liberal theory, like we talk about now. They just know they've always been left alone, and therefore that's how people live. You make your own governments, you make your own businesses, you make your own families, you make your own fraternal groups, you make your own religions. That's America. America is all about choosing what is best, and you do it. Nobody has the right to tell you how to choose. So if I were to say, for example, to probably the greatest free trader of his day, John Hancock, you must have read Adam Smith and The Wealth of Nations. You must understand economic theory. He would just scratch his head and say, well, what do you mean? I ship goods. Why would anybody have the right to tell me where to ship the goods or what to pay for those goods? That's just what I do. So liberalism is never a theory in America. And in fact, The Wealth of Nations doesn't even sell in America until about the 1830s. All of our free market theory is just practice. We've been left alone. That's the way people live. So here's where it gets a little more complicated. All the laws to regulate trade have all been passed. I want you guys to read this in Tyndall's sheet. But they've all been passed a century prior to the Revolution. They were called the Navigation Acts. There are a whole series of acts that are passed in Britain that try and regulate trade. But this is awesome. I don't want to get into all of this right now. But this was also the same time period in which you had a huge conflict between king and parliament. So what happened was a lot of these laws, the navigation laws, were passed, but they gave the king the right to enforce and not parliament. So parliament passed them, but they were handed on to the king to deal with. Well, remember in 1688, the Glorious Revolution, the king has taken down about 50 pegs. And so you've got all these laws, but with nobody interested in enforcing them. And this is why all these laws are passed that deal with American economics, but no one ever, ever tries to enforce them. Salutary neglect is the term that Edmund Burke gives to this. And he says, why have Americans developed? Well, salutary means good. It's good neglect. So these laws aren't ever enforced. Jeff?
For what year was?
For the Navigation Acts? There are some passed in the 1650s under Cromwell, and then some in the 1660s and 1670s. But the Navigation Acts are just a whole series of acts where the British are trying to decide if they do want an empire or not. And if they do want them, they're going to need these things. So the Navigation Acts regulate what can be produced, what can be moved from one part of the British Empire, or British, it's not empire yet, but one part of Britain to another part. and how much it would charge and so forth, what shipping rates are, everything. So, does that help, Jeff?
Yeah.
Okay. So, here's, I just want to talk briefly about this. This whole theory that was, that the British kind of flirt with, but the Spanish and the French go whole hog about, this is a theory called mercantilism. And mercantilism doesn't mean no trade. And in fact, well, I mean, definitely not a mercantilist, but mercantilism doesn't mean no trade. It means very heavily regulated trade. So we actually have not had, okay, I don't want to get too far into this. Let me just put it this way. If it doesn't make sense, tell me. We now have a president, even though he's only been in the White House for a week or so, who is probably the most mercantilist president we've had since probably Herbert Hoover. So there's always been in American history, we love the idea of free trade, we never practice it, except for under Grover Cleveland, we had free trade for a bit, and prior to the American Revolution, we had free trade. Ever since the government has come into effect in the US Constitution, we've always had fairly high tariff rates, and we've not been a free trade people, which kind of, from my perspective, grates at me, but we're now in a position, we hear on Trump, his whole argumentation about shipping jobs to Mexico or China and unfairness, it's all mercantilist. So mercantilism is this, it's not anti-trade. It says that trade should always be carried out for the benefit of a certain people as opposed to all people. So this is why when Trump says, okay, we want to bring Ford back to Michigan and out, and I'm just using, I don't remember the example, but we want to take it away from Mexico and bring labor back. This is, it may be a good, I'm not going to get political about it, but it's very much mercantilist theory. The argument is, we've been allowing non-Americans to take advantage of the trade system. Now it's our turn to take advantage of it. These are the same arguments that were used during the imperial period. And the basis of this, and Trump may be a brilliant guy, I'm not commenting on him in particular, and he may not be, but regardless, the theory of mercantilism is this. The resources of the world, whether it's gold or people, are limited. So there are always limitations in the world. And therefore, the idea is with mercantilism, one people should grab as much stuff as possible before another people do. So let's just, as an absurd argument, let's just say there are only 1,000 pounds of gold in the entire world. Well, if the Spanish get a hold of 60% of that, everybody else in the world has to fight over the 40% that remains. And what mercantilism cannot take into account, and they're not stupid, there are a lot of bright mercantilists, but what they don't take into account, which is something, you know, if you have Dr. von Grassig or Dr. Martin, they'll just rip this to shreds, and I agree with them, I think they're right, I'm pretty much a pro-free trade guy, but the argument is under mercantilism, they don't take into account innovation. So if they see a beach, all they see is sand. Now they may see a lot of sand, but they don't see the possibility that that sand can be turned into silicone chips that will then become the basis of all modern computing. They don't get that because they can't see innovation. What they see is use of resources, and you either have it or you don't. So that's what mercantilist theory is based on at its root, that there are only limited resources. So the Navigation Acts and mercantilism are based on that. Americans from day one, they don't have to argue about this, they just don't live this way. Americans are all about innovation, they're all about free trade, free prices. Okay, does that make sense? So our liberalism is never theoretical, it's just practical. It's what you do. Okay, so let me jump to the second thing again. And what is a republic? So the Americans are very taken, and I'm with them 100% on this for what it's worth. They're very taken with the idea of a republic as the highest form of government. And what they mean by that is literally a recreation of the Roman Republic and learning from it and its mistakes. But they believe in the res publica, that is Latin for the good thing, which we call Congress, to congress, to come together, which, if any of you, anyone know what the Icelandic parliament's called?
Oh, you told us last semester.
Yeah, it's the thing. It's the republic. It's the good thing. It's just called the thing, the all thing, the all thing. And same thing in Scandinavia. Parliament is another name for it. So the res publica means this, and I hear my fellow libertarians bash a republic because they tend to think of it as some kind of form of a nice name for collectivizing. It's not what it means. It's the common good, and what that means is every one of us in this room has a stake that is common. That is, we all own an equal share in our governance. And the reason the word res publica is brought up is because they are fighting against the Etruscan notion that you can have all things concentrated in a king. Therefore, a private wealth is when the god king owns all, and you and I are just his playthings and subjects. So a commonwealth doesn't mean socialism. It means no god king. So the res publica is a way that we contribute. And this is also, I want you guys to write this down for now. We'll keep coming back to it. But the res publica means common good. It does not mean in any way greater good. A greater good is not the same thing as a common good. A greater good means we make a cost-benefit analysis and one people benefit at the expense of another. A common good says we all give up a little bit, so we all gain. That's what the common good is. So everybody loses a little bit, but you have no distinct losers and no distinct winners, because everybody loses a little and everybody gains a lot. Whereas in the greater good, you actually make decisions which group will be benefited and which one will be disadvantaged. That's democracy. It's not a republic. That's what a democracy is. The democracy is always a greater good. A republic is the common good. So from the American perspective, there were four things that were absolutely necessary to a functioning republic. Number one is virtue. Again, Roman term, that is to be fully human. Here too, to be a man, to be a human. And there's an irony in this, because in order to be virtuous, you have to give yourself away. Virtue at its highest point is not about grabbing stuff. It's about giving stuff. It's about leavening. It's about making the other person better. So virtue literally, and this is the irony of it, it's about being fully human, but being fully human means helping one another. So it's not about acquisition. It's about giving. So, and this is kind of a cheesy example, but I'll make it anyway. Virtue can be on a full spectrum. So, and I can't really use this argument as well anymore because my oldest child is 17 and my youngest is 5, so none of them are in diapers anymore. The diaper stage is horrible at every level. It's the only time I've ever cussed at a relative. I cussed at my mother-in-law and told her to get the hell out of the room when I was trying to change my first diaper. So that was not good. I don't recommend that. It just is. And I love my mother-in-law. It's intense. The first diaper, man. Anyway, so one of the things my wife often did for me when I was teaching, and she was not, of course she's teaching now again, but the kids are older, but one of the things she would often do, and I always had 8 o'clock classes, if the baby needed a diaper change in the middle of the night, she got up and took care of it, which was really, really nice, partly because I have sleep problems, and if I wake up in the middle of the night, I have a very hard time getting back to sleep. And so my wife, who can sleep through anything, she got up and she did that. That's an act of virtue. In every way. She got up. It's a minor act. It doesn't change the world. But it's a thing of grace. It's beautiful. It's an act of love. She gets up and takes care of that so I can sleep. Well, you could also have this. Every one of the guys who died on the beaches of Normandy, that's the ultimate act of love. They do that because they believe in America and they're willing to give their lives at the highest cost. So that's all on the spectrum. Everything from changing a diaper to giving your life out of love. That's all in the spectrum of virtue. But virtue is never, you could never be selfish and be virtuous. Virtue is always about the giving of self, always. We pervert it sometimes. So love becomes lust. It's avarice or acquisition. But real love is making the person you love better, not making them like you. So this was essential. Now the founders never ever believed, they're not in an airy way thinking we can all be this way. But what they argue is there must always be a small minority of citizens who are willing to give everything. Whether it's on the beaches of Normandy or in the classroom or from the pulpit or around the dinner table. There always has to be a number of people, and our job, as those of us who aren't virtuous, because you can never call yourself virtuous, the moment you do that, you've lost all virtue. Virtue can only be bestowed by another. You have to act virtuously, but you can't proclaim it. It's quiet. Just like Jesus says, if you pray, you know, go into a dark room and do it silently. Don't make a show of it. Same thing with virtue. So virtue can only be bestowed by another, but we have to act it out. And therefore, from their perspective, all we do is we allow those who will be virtuous, whether they're Marines or ministers or whatever they are, we just let them be. That's all we have to do. They give themselves fully. We don't stop them. We don't mock them. We don't interfere with them. We just allow that to happen because that's what we need. And Washington is the ultimate symbol of Republican virtue for America. And we'll talk about why that's the case later. But giving everything, he'd always rather be with Martha. Always. But he can't because he's got to fight. He's got to be president of the Constitutional Convention. He's got to be president of the United States. He doesn't want to do any of that. He wants to be home with his wife. But he has to keep doing that. It's ultimate virtue. Number two, though, we believe, and the founders called this property. Number two, we have to have the freedom to choose. Virtue, if I say, Logan, there's a homeless guy I saw down on the Bobby's Trail. You need to go take care of it right now. And by the way, if you don't, you will suffer greatly in this class. Well, I could force him to do it. And it would be a good. If Logan went down and helped the homeless guy, that's a good. But if Logan, on his own free will, saw the homeless person and took care of them, that's a virtue. It's not a virtue if I make him do it. It's only a virtue if he, of his own free will, chooses. And what the founders meant by property was not owning stuff. I own this book. It is my property, and you could violate it. Big deal. But if you hurt me, or you stop me, or if I say to Logan, you are now my servant, you have no choice, and Logan can probably take me pretty easy if there's a struggle, but let's say he couldn't, well then, I violated his property. Property doesn't mean stuff, it means person. So I either have control of my soul, or I don't. That's what property means. I either own myself or I don't. Number three, which is not so politically correct in our modern world, is that in order for a person to be a person, they have not just the right, but the duty to arm themselves. In other words, you better be willing at any moment to lay down your life for what you believe is truth. Whether it's your wife or your children or your God or your country, you better be able to do that. And it's not good enough that your neighbor has a gun. You better know how to use it, and you better know how to do it. Again, we may agree or disagree, and some of you from urban areas, this is probably a little shocking, but remember, this is a society where it is incumbent upon you to defend yourself. It's incumbent. So you have to be able to do that. And finally, number four, we believe in extreme decentralization. That is, we want government to be decentralized. If we can go into a college campus, it's good for the campus to take care of it. If we can get a sorority or fraternity or one of the fraternal groups on campus to take care of it, maybe the honors, the collegiate program, that's where we want it. We want all power to be as local as possible. In Catholicism, for those of you who come out of the Catholic tradition, this is called subsidiarity. But this is federalism or just decentralization in the Republican theory. So all power devolves to the lowest possible level. That's where power is best used and trusted. Okay, so does that make sense for everyone? We're going to keep coming back to these, but I also want you to keep these in mind as you think about Cato and reading Cato. Okay, so I'm going to end with something today. I'm going to tell you a story and talk about what this means because we've only got about 8 minutes left. So there's a great place in America. It's actually, even though I love Colorado more than anything else, if you said, Brad, where would we find, by the way, you can't call me Brad, unfortunately, until you graduate, but then you have to. So that's just school rules. If you were to say to me after you graduate, Brad, where does America start? I would point you to one place. I've got a little map there. It's not a great map, but to one place, Lexington, Massachusetts. To me, the entire spirit of everything I'm talking about happened on April 19th of 1775 in this one spot. Lexington, Massachusetts is a very, very typical New England town. It is all Calvinist. Maybe not the kind of Calvinism we would recognize, but they see themselves as that. Everybody knows everybody. They're all part of the same community. They're truly a small republic within the larger republic. They are the res publica of Lexington. And the most prominent person there is a man we've almost entirely forgotten, much to our own shame. The pastor of the church there, the congregation church, which means he's the lead guy in the town, a guy by the name of Jonas Clark. Pastor Clark has been there since about 1756. He's only the third pastor ever in this town. You know, once you're head pastor, you kind of keep it until you're dead. And he's the third pastor, and he's a great intellectual. In fact, he has one of the 9 largest libraries in all of North America. Great guy. Anybody can go to his house and borrow a book. This is before the Republic Libraries, before Franklin starts that. And all you do is if you borrow a book from Pastor Clark, he says, when you come back to me, we have to have tea, and you have to give me a book review. That's it. Great guy. Everybody consults him. Everybody knows him. John Adams loves him. Sam Adams loves him. John Hancock loves him. Paul Revere loves him. Everybody knows him. And he has been giving sermons since about 1765, talking about what it means to be a Christian and a Republican, small R Republican, to believe in a republic, and what is manliness. And his argument is exactly what we've just been talking about. In fact, what I just gave you over the last 41 minutes could be one of his sermons, looking about what is the duty of a Republican Christian, which is, for him, synonymous. A good Republican is a Christian, and a good Christian is a Republican, small r. And so what happens? You guys all know this story that you may not have known. Clark was a major part of it. At about 5 minutes till midnight on April 18th of 1775, one of his good friends, man, silversmith by the name of Paul Revere, is banging on his door, just obnoxiously banging on the door. And Clark's really ticked off. And he wakes up, and he goes and he opens the door. Revere, what are you doing here at midnight? And Revere, of course, has been sent by land to by sea. And he is there to tell Clark that there are 6,600 British troops moving from Boston towards Concord, and most likely they will pass right by his house and he'll be arrested. Everybody knows he's one of the great leaders. He happens to have in his house that night a guest, John Hancock, and another, St. Adams. And you know, that's a threefer if the British can show up. And Clark's befuddled. He's like, oh, what do we do? Ring the bells. Ring the church bells. Go out there immediately. And so they ring the bells about 10 minutes after midnight. The entire town, all the kids, all the women, all the men, everybody in the area comes down to it. I'm going to make this a little bit bigger here. The green coming from Boston, they call it a green or a square. It's actually a triangle. Part of the road goes up to northern New England. The other part goes to Concord. So this is the road to Concord, that's to northern New England, and this is to Boston. Jonas Clark's house is right there on the green, and there are houses everywhere, all along the green, businesses. The community church is right there, it doesn't exist anymore, unfortunately, and the pub is right there, next to Jonas Clark's house. These are the three, very typical for New England. Three centers of power: church, the pub, and the pastor's house. Very typical. So they ring the bells, everybody comes out, everybody. All the lights are on. And what do they decide? They don't know. Got 6,600 British Marines here, and we've only got 42 men with guns. What do we do? And they debate for 4 hours, and about 4:21 in the morning, here come the British troops coming through. And what the Lexingtonians decide under Clark, again, fantastic figure, is the 42 men will stand at attention and at honor in parade formation, not at military ready. They know that the British troops will be going this way because they've got to go to Concord where they're supposed to arrest a number of people. So all 42 men stand as far away as possible, and that, by the way, would be about from here over to the Dow Hotel. It's pretty far. That's not just across the street. Right? It's a ways. So they know the troops are going to come this way. They stand there at 4:20 in the morning, just simply at parade formation to show their men, their community, and it's one military honoring another. That's it. However, just in case things go wrong, all of the British, all of the Lexingtonian gunpowder has been moved to the attic of the church, and there is a man standing there with an open torch, and if the British enter the church, he has to blow it up. So he's standing there the whole time, just in case. They don't want anybody getting desecrating the church. They'd rather destroy it. They don't want the British in there. So they're all waiting, and all the women, all the children are around the square, standing on their front porches. The British come through about 4:21 in the morning, and the head of the British, just this arrogant, nasty man, who sees these 42 men, and of course they see the whole population around the town, he's infuriated. He walks up to the soldiers, that is, the militia. He tells the Lexingtonians, "This is illegal, you have an illegal gathering here, you must disperse." And the Lexingtonians say, we're just honoring you. Nope, you have guns, you're a threat, disperse now. And the men are befuddled, and they start packing up their guns, and they're ashamed, and they, of course, they're outnumbered, 6,600 to 42. And they start walking back to their homes, and somehow, we don't know how, but a shot's fired. We don't know where. It could have been somebody in the pub. It could have been one of the British soldiers. We have no idea. And the Lexingtonian men immediately pull their arms and train them on the Brits, and the Brits open fire. And immediately 10 Americans are killed, right in front of the whole community. One guy, who was the town physician, had his guts blown out. Mm-hmm. His stomach was ripped open, his entrails were hanging out. He crawled during the melee across the street to his wife. He lived in this corner, right here. He's shot, he crawls to his wife and dies in her arms about 10 minutes later. This is as personal and bloody and brutal as you can imagine. British do their thing. They keep marching onto Concord. New Englanders are infuriated, and the Lexingtonians are embarrassed. We didn't do well, we stood out, we were fools, and we may have started a conflict. No shots have been fired yet until this moment. And everybody already thinks we Calvinists are insane, we Yankees, and now we're going to get all of America into a war. That's not what happens. Word goes out, soldiers open fire on a legitimate assembly of men in front of the community, and everybody is infuriated. Americans are absolutely infuriated. By the time these British soldiers get to Concord, there are thousands of farmers with their guns utterly ticked off waiting for them. And the Brits realize they've got to get out of there. And they start running back to Boston. And the Massachusetts farmers line up on both sides of the road. And as the British troops are running back, they're firing point blank at these guys. It is brutal in every way. But of course, it's the battle cry. Lexington is the beginning of everything. And I want you to think about this. Here we are. Think about all the ideas we've talked about. Everything. Republicanism, liberalism, all of this. And when it comes down to it, it's basically a momentary decision of one community trying to figure out how to save face in the middle of the night. And people behaving as Americans. That, to me, the first Lexingtonian who died there was the first American. That's our legacy. That's who we are. Okay, God bless everybody. I'll see you on Monday. Have a great weekend.
What's that?
What if Winston said Washington's wife's name was Martha?
Thomas is telling the difference.
I just love because of that man.
Why'd you say this name?
Yeah. I think the most effective scene in the whole movie.
I actually like it, but I think I could. I don't mean this to sound patronizing. I think you have to be a little older. I mean, when I was your age, I would have thought that was ridiculous, too. Now, I kind of get it, but.